It's 11:15, so it's time for Wine Chat with Cal. The price of wine has been a hotly contested space, but how much difference is there in what goes into a $150 bottle of Burgundy versus a $9 fruity dry white? What actually makes a wine expensive to make? Are certain wines cheaper to make than others? Does the depth of the punt in a bottle actually mean that wine is better? To answer these questions and more, we are joined by our very own fruity dry white, Cal Lee. How are you today?
You know, this is actually the first time I've been called that.
No, it's,
you know, hey, look, I am to please. You know, it does what it says on the label, and that's the main thing.
Sometimes it's all you need. Sometimes all you need is a fruity dry white.
Exactly, you know.
Okay. Can you outline some of the main features that contribute to a wine's price?
Totally. I guess there's sort of two main camps for these kinds of things. There's what I would call the more ephemeral features. And these are things that are sort of really hard to sort of put a specific pin on. It's stuff like, you know, reputation and prestige. There's some aspect of also like market forces in there that have more to do with sort of the fashionability of like particular regions or particular grapes and stuff like that. And that's all well and good, but that's sort of like not really what I want to focus on today. So what I sort of want to focus down on is sort of like the key things that will basically end up affecting the total cost of a wine and sort of then in turn what you then have to charge the wine. And that's basically it's like how much does it cost to get fruit in? What are your expenses when making the actual wine? And then at the end, it's like sort of what is your bottling, labeling, all that kind of process there, and how much is that going to cost you? And there's sort of your three camps of sort of where different expenditures arise in the process of costing out a wine.
And what different differences fruit make when it comes to the cost of a wine?
Yeah, there's actually, I think, a lot more variability in fruit prices than a lot of people realize. You know, like when I was in South Australia earlier this year, I knew people who were paying about $4,000 a ton for, you know, some pretty primo organically farmed Grenache. I also heard of people trying to get rid of like some Shiraz at about $100 a ton. And, you know, it's a pretty wide gap. And I guess just for context for our listeners who sort of might not know, a ton, that's kilos. But when you're sort of doing the sort of back of the napkin mathematics on this stuff, you broadly assume that for every 1 ton of grapes, you'll get 750 litres, and then, you know, 750 litres for a 750ml bottle means you're getting 1,000 bottles. So basically, when I say a ton of fruit, I'm basically talking about that turning into roughly 1,000 bottles of wine, give or take, you know, some other factors there. I was going to say, the other thing that I think is important to recognise when it comes to fruit costing as well is that if you own the vineyard, obviously, you're not buying fruit per ton. Your costs are about maintaining, you know, that actual vineyard space. And so what you'll have a lot of times is, especially vineyards that are more premium or, you know, have some really, really good pedigree, is that they will keep their sort of top-end grapes. The cost of the actual managing of the whole vineyard is pretty flat, regardless of sort of which rows you're talking about. But they'll sell off some of their lower quality stuff, which basically covers the cost then of whatever extra maintenance is required for those sort of higher-end grapes. And so your actual fruit cost then is actually a lot lower than if you were to in the equivalent fruit from the grape grower.
And so how much does it actually cost to make the wine? Is natural wine cheaper to make because you do less work, or is that just sort of a bit assumptive?
Yeah, it sort of depends on how much of a cowboy you are. You know, like there are definitely some, let's call them natural winemakers out there who, you know, they chuck a bunch of grapes in a bucket and then sort of let it go and then, you know, bottle it 4 weeks later. And then, you know, it's a true expression of the vintage. And,
it
you
is
know, all that stuff.
Technically fermented grape juice.
It 100% is. You know, from the natural or like, you know, very low sulfur intervention sort of wineries I've worked in personally, the actual amount of labor that goes into every process is significantly higher than working in a more commercially and traditionally orientated winery. And I think that sort of gets lost in a lot of the conversations is that sort of when you're making a wine in a commercial setting, because you have chemical protections and chemical interventions, you sort of always have a chance to fix things later on down the line. Whereas if you're making a wine that's minimal intervention, if you're making it completely naturally, you don't really get those options. So it requires things like your hygiene and your processing, and making sure you're, you know, you're working in low oxygen environments to be really, really precise from the very, very start of the process. And you don't really get to cut any corners when it comes to the labor aspect of it. So whilst it might be a lot cheaper because, you know, you're not having to pay outlay for buying, you know, citric acid or sulfur dioxide or whatever your additions are, the labor aspect of it is a lot more intensive. And I think the other thing that a lot of people don't realize is the really, really big cost producing wines is oak. Oak barrels are expensive. They're pretty much mostly handmade, you know, like coopering is sort of a dying art form in that way. But I guess for context, you know, I was talking to Jeremy from BS&B, and, you know, he got a new 600-litre Stockinger oak barrel, and that cost him over $6,000. So, you know, think about that in terms of, like, how much, like, that's not even making 100 bottles of wine, but that's a $6,000 cost. You've then added on to the price of every single bottle going into that. And then you sort of start to see why the idea of oak reuse is so important to a lot of wineries, or having like an oak aging program, because these things are really, really expensive to get into the winery, and they're really, really important for a lot of wine styles. But you can't afford to put, unless you're in California, like you can't really afford to put everything in new oak every year, because just the pure cost outlay of purchasing barrels would kind of send any winery bankrupt.
Yeah, and on storage then, what about bottles? So how much does a bottle cost to make and purchase?
Yeah, and this is sort of going back to that punt question earlier, you know. When we talk about bottling, there's sort of three main cost components. It's the physical glass that you're putting something in. There's what we call your closure, which is whatever goes on the top and keeps the wine inside. And then there's obviously your label. Labeling is pretty standardized. You know, you can do fancier things like, you know, a foil or an emboss, and that will increase your price slightly. A lot of wines have a front label and a back label. Putting two labels on a bottle is more expensive than putting one label on a bottle, but that's not particularly exciting. But when it comes to the actual glass, there actually is quite a lot of variability there. Not just in terms of like really obvious things like color, you know, the glass tends to be cheaper than green glass. Why a lot of sort of entry-level like rosés or sort of like fruity, you know, the more approachable, fun drinking wines, you know, your chilled reds, your rosés, and your dry whites tend to be in clearer bottles just because they're cheaper to make. People like to see the direct color of it. And because they're not designed to age in any way, you don't need that extra protection from having darker glass. Whereas, you know, something like a more significant Shiraz, you want a dark glass in it, so it's not at risk of like UV damage or light strike or anything like that. But that actual glass is more expensive. And the real thing that makes glass expensive is how thick the material actually is. This is where, so yeah, that deep punt thing comes from. It's like, does it mean the wine is better? Maybe, but it's a pretty expensive kind of bottle shape to manufacture and purchase. So you're not going to put a cheap wine in it, because at that point you're just adding cost to a product that would do better in market with a simpler bottle type, and you sort of wouldn't have to worry about it. And I do just want to briefly sort of mention closure types. We deal with two main ones in Australia here, the screw cap that everyone's pretty familiar with. Shout outs to CSU for coming up with that one. And then, you know, your cork closure. Corks are more expensive. There's lots of different grades of cork. You sort of quite commonly see what we call an agglomerated cork, which is basically it's made up of all these tiny little bits of recycled cork. They're the cheapest ones you can get. They also have the highest failure rate out of all cork seals. And so a trend I've noticed a lot recently is seeing a lot of people trying to have a more premium appearance by going back to cork for a higher tier of wine. using quite cheap cork materials, which is just leading to, you know, an increase in failure rate. You also see a lot of waxing on sort of a lot of these wines, which is cute and serves an aesthetic purpose, but doesn't sort of provide any actual functional protection to the wine. A lot of people do bad wax jobs, and that's a whole other kettle of fish, which just means you end up with wax in the bottle every time you try and open it. I could have names here, but I'm not going to. whereas the screw cap, whilst it is seen as maybe a little less classy, and is sort of really frowned upon in a lot of sort of old world, specifically France, winemaking regions, as sort of being crude and improper, is much more effective at actually preserving a wine, is much easier to reseal. They're cheaper to do and they're cheaper to implement. So a lot of the reliance on cork still is much more to do with the perception of higher quality and the sort of like legacy of prestige than actually having any material benefit to the wine.
Fair enough, fair enough. And so what are you drinking this week?
I am drinking a really beautiful Mâcon Village. It's a North Inc. terroir, but number 5 terroir, which is like a really, really fun little number. Mâcon in Burgundy, Chardonnay. It's Chardonnay time for me. But this is a really great example of the style in the region from a wine that is sort of pricing itself out of the market. And this one's actually quite approachable. So I think if you're sort of looking to get into more serious French wines, but you sort of don't necessarily want to be spending that, you know, 100, 200, 250 bucks on sort of a bottle of Chardonnay, this is a really great example that you can sort of find. It's pretty well distributed, you know, but it's at a much more approachable price point that I think is a really great starting point for sort of getting people the Burgundy bug, as it were.
Brilliant. Well, thanks again, Cal, for coming on this morning, having a chat about wine on Wine Chat, surprisingly. We'll see you next week.
I'll see you next week.